thank you for taking the time to download and listen to this podcast from Celtic Underground. You are possibly picking this up on thecelticunderground.substack.com. If you are a paid subscriber, you can link your account to wherever you pick up your podcasts, whether that be Spotify, Apple, Amazon, wherever, and you can pick up the subscription feed where you get your normal feed. Just go on to Substack on the website and follow the instructions. Meantime, this is Andrew H. Smith in conversation.
Hi, welcome to Celtic Underground in Conversation series, where this week, it's a privilege, we've got the doyen, the modern day doyen of Scottish football writers, and also a man who's close to my heart because he has never blanched at acknowledging Celtic as his footballing cornerstone. Hugh MacDonald, great to have you on.
Nice to see you, Andrew, and good to be on, yeah.
You kind of came to the scene, I was trying to work it out, because you certainly, when I joined the Scotland on Sunday or the Evening Times even, you would have been probably in that office, the old office, as a sub back then, were you, like in the room next door, the kind of Herald room, if you like? We were in the Evening Times.
Yeah.
You in the Herald then?
Yeah, I was in the Herald from basically the early 70s onwards, basically, or certainly the mid-70s onwards. In various roles, I was, ended up chief sub-editor on the news side, and then I became, in a strange flip, I became literary editor, and then I moved to the news desk, the sports desk, in the early 2000s, and I became chief sports writer about 20 years ago.
That's maybe the time as I thought of, because I remembered, I think it was the one just before Celtic won the league in 98, and I had to go into the Evening Times office, and I was never, but I think I was getting a lift with Ian Paul. But you actually, like, you know, and they were all sitting around, as subs would sit around to explain to people, they would just be at the desks and at their computers, so they would sit there all day getting the copy in and changing, making any tweaks to it. And I always wondered, were you there that day? But you know, my famous memory of it is your man Scott, Ian Scott, because it was Celtic were playing Rangers. I think it was the Scottish Cup one that Rangers won at Celtic Park. They had to flip a coin for it. And he was going down at the game, but he was sitting there at his computer typing away in the big Rangers scarf. And I thought this was astonishing. You know, like
Scotty was a great, great, the late Scotty, unfortunately, is a great, great friend of mine. You know, the old one, I danced at his wedding, you know. His wedding up in Tarbert Loch Fyne, a great man. And he was quite open, obviously, about his Rangers affiliations as well. I always thought it was a bit kind of daft to be otherwise, you know. I mean, people used to say to me, oh, you're quite open about it. I remember I was on Jim Traynor's programme. I can't remember, was it Press Pack or something?
Yeah, they used to do the kind of Lady Gaga paparazzi kind of intro, didn't they? Paparazzi.
I was on that, and Jim was trying to trap me in front of the microphone as he did in his usual mischievous way, and said, I understand, Hugh, what team do you support? And I said, well, I couldn't possibly tell you that. And he was getting quite energised, ready to become the attack dog. And I said, but I will say, there's a book called Celtic Minded, and I wrote chapter 3. So that might give you a clue. But my view of it all is, it's a personal view, whatever anybody wants to do, they want to do themselves. Where I was brought up in west of Scotland, I mean, it was not unusual to be a Celtic fan or a Rangers fan. They were the two dominant things. To wander about and tell people that you supported somebody else, you know, you're the famous Partick Thistle fan or something like that, just seemed daft to me. But it's really strange that I went to a lot of Partick Thistle games when I was young.
It's 5 minutes up the road from here.
Ah, exactly. Went to one of my, you know, the old uncles, you know, that you had. He was a great Jags man, so he would every now and again have got there. But no, I've never found it I never found any reason to sort of deny it, you know. It's just, it's part of me, you know.
But as a, do you think it made a difference, the fact that you're coming into it a wee bit, well, a lot later, I suppose, than most? Is it, you're talking the early 2000s that you really joined the beat, the early 2000s then. So you're maybe, what, you're in your late 40s or whatever by then?
50, I would say, aye.
Well, thank you. I always have to kind of, I went down.
I'm 70
so
now.
So in your 50s. So in your
50s. I'm 70 now, and it was maybe about, yeah, I'd be 50s. I'm talking about, can't be precise about it, but I'm talking about probably 2005, 6, 7, round about then, yeah. So I'd be middle, the best part of 20 years ago, and I'm 70 now, so I'd be getting into my 50s, you know.
And how did you find it? Because it probably changed a lot, I'd say, even in the kind of, for 15 years by then I'd been in around the scene, it very much changed this kind of, people maybe don't want to believe this, but this kind of hold that Rangers had on the kind of narrative, that had started to kind of flake away, or would you, what would you think about that? If, I mean, that's what people from outside, I'm sure you get it the same way that I got it. It's like, oh, how can you work in that environment or that? Because it wasn't quite what you think it is, or was, in the sense of Rangers having that, Murray was still around, I suppose.
Murray was still around, but Murray was a depleted character in by that time. It was obvious that the Murray, you know, sort of, what you want to call it, experiment or theory, was heading towards some kind of trouble. I think in a longer narrative, one of the most significant things, you know, there's huge unrest at Celtic at the moment, is that the way in this century, where for me it's hugely interesting. Like, I've watched Celtic in eight different decades. From the 50s right through. First game was in 59.
Right.
And so the biggest thing about me in reflection is, you know, is what's happened in the 21st century to Celtic, where you can see now, you know, that they're the biggest club in Scotland, and you know, most, if not all, metrics. And they're very, very powerful politically and economically. You know, they've got huge voice in what happens in Scottish football. And that was never the case in the previous century. I mean, it was always, even during 9 in a row, for example, the first 9 in a row, you would, you know, people would still accept, you know, Rangers are the Bank of Scotland club, they've got the influence, you know, and that flipped, and it's very hard for people of a younger age, I think, to appreciate how it flipped, and how, again, I always laugh, you know, when there's Christmas, I always say quite clearly that I'm a loyalist, you know, I believe that he's a real significant figure in Celtic's history, and he was a driving force that, you know, that put Celtic. For an example, for a man of my age to hear accusations that Celtic run the SFA and SPFL. It's really funny, you know, because I was brought up in things like, you know, we never get anything, we're the underdogs, and some of it was, you know, the Jim Farry case, etc., etc., etc. There was demonstrations of that, you know, and for now to be, generally accepted that Celtic are very, very, you know, they're powerful and influential in Scottish football and its guidance and direction. I think that's the biggest change in my life.
Yeah. I mean, were you still on the scene, were you on the scene when Simon Buckland was still around, when Buckle was still around?
Yeah.
Yeah, because, you know, he said this thing to me that always struck me. We should explain, Simon Buckland was a, loved him a bit. Like, he was up here, come up from London, he was a big Chelsea supporter. And we used to drive to games together a lot and all that. And he said to me, you know, the problem with Scottish football journalism, he said, the Rangers supporters are harder on Celtic than they are on Rangers. And the Celtic supporters are harder on Celtic than they are on Rangers. He said, therefore, you've got, like most of the people, being harder on Celtic. And I thought about that, and it kind of changed my writing, because that was true. In my early days of Scotland Sunday, I was so desperate not to be seen to be favouring Celtic. And, yeah. and Celtic is emotional for you. So if Celtic are bad, and they were bad and such, like because Advocaat was winning trebles and all that, it's hard to criticise teams when they are winning trebles and whatever, you know. But like, so I was getting stuck right in the Celtic. And then something, when speaking to Simon about that, I thought, well, I need to be sure that I'm going to be just as hard on Rangers if they fall in hard times. And of course, Celtic started to run the show under O'Neill in those early. So it changed. Rangers were 13 points behind. Advocaat's team was 13 points behind in October. Remember when he made his famous fatnecks statement, which I think he meant it was a mistranslation, fatnecks, and he meant to say big heads, didn't he? But I suppose it was just maybe the words would get spun around. Like, I always remember reading this when Celtic signed De Cano, actually, that he'd fallen out with Capello because he'd called him a penis face. This is what it was in the Times. It was a fact file on Paolo De Cano. They don't mean penis face, surely they mean dickhead, don't they? Who's ever called a penis face? Anyway, I digress, but would you know, I've seen that then. You don't think, I mean, people we know well, let's be honest, that another Hugh in the scene, you would say, he seems to be always much harder on Celtic than he is on Rangers, maybe to make a point.
Yeah, I think there's that dynamic in you. Certainly, when I look back, the biggest arguments I had in football, and the biggest fallouts, was at Celtic. I can't remember a big fallout with anybody at Rangers at all, actually. But I can remember a few big fallouts with people at Celtic. I had a particularly bad one with, a volatile one with Gordon Strachan. And now looking back, I can really, you know, I can more than see his point in the, I think I was too intemperate with my language and my writing about it, and I can see why he would be upset at that. So, yeah, the biggest ones were with Celtic, and I agree with you. I mean, I always think about, you can expand it just beyond journalism to pundits. I mean, those at Celtic would say that Celtic pundits, you know, like Charlie Nick, like Chris Sutton, a few others would be, you know,
Andy Walker used to
would be properly critical of Celtic. I think, you know, every band's entitled to a view, but you wouldn't have the same thing on the Rangers side. The Rangers pundits wouldn't be slaughtering Rangers. So you would, you know, there was, I don't know what, I think it's, it brings me to the, a bit to the you know, what's going on at Celtic at the moment. Is there an element in the Celtic mindedness that well, we are more critical, that we are more unaccepting of things? I just find it intriguing at the moment. And the reason I find it intriguing, I was over in Marseille a couple of months ago for Marseille v Paris Saint-Germain, you know, PSG. And I met a couple of French journalists that I'd known from the tennis beat. I used to do a lot of tennis back in the day when Andy Murray was about. And they were completely, the first thing they said, come here, sit down here and explain to me the Celtic crisis, because they couldn't understand it. Because they keep saying, like, you've got a team that's won 13 out of 14 leagues or whatever. It's got 70 million in the bank. It's got sellable assets. Why is everybody up there? And see, when you've actually got to sit down and explain that from an outside point of view, it really is quite difficult. It becomes, because they keep throwing back, you say to yourself, well, you know, there's an element, there's a disconnect between them and the fans. And you say, well, what's the disconnect? So you've got to get into that. And you say, well, people think they're unambitious, but they're winning the league all the time and they're playing in Europe. So it's very difficult to explain to an outside culture what is happening in our culture. And much of it is, I think, is fueled by that, you know, people, I don't know if it's just Celtic, but it's certainly prevalent of Celtic, of people being very questioning, very aware of what's happening in the club, and very aware of how they want things to be, you know. It's It's not like when you go to many clubs, particularly in England, which I do a lot, where a lot of it is there's a distance anyway between the fans and the clubs, and they accept that, you know? So it's, I find it really intriguing to actually say, well, what is the problem here? And more than intriguing, absolutely impossible to come up with an answer of, you know, what is the resolution to all this.
Well, thereby hangs another tale, eh? But for you, I suppose, even you said you dared to say on the Celtic Underground podcast, although it's one of the ones you probably could say without like getting a lynch mob at you, but you were a loyalist. And it's quite intriguing to me that there was so much focus for him for all the ills of Celtic. And then you have a transfer window that if he'd have still been the chairman, he would have been getting blamed for that transfer window going exactly the same as it did.
Yeah, but he was getting the blame for everything, you know.
Yeah.
When he was chairman, for example, I mean, there was people writing and you know, saying all Lowell's, you know, dead-handed. And the real story, and I think one of the difficulties of Celtic in the last 18 months was that Peter Lowell had no great input into football matters. But to say that, you can hear the howling, of course he had. And you know, you say, well, actually, no, differently. It became very much a pantomime villain kind of thing, just somebody to stick the pin on. I mean, and I know there'll be people shouting and bawling at it. I mean, I get it regularly on social media if I write something about it. And I don't really bother with that because people are more than entitled to their own view of that. But, you know, when you come out, like, got to remember there's the great facets of Celtic media, Celtic Twitter, is why didn't we kick on in 2003 after Seville and Peter Lovell's blamed for all that? And then you say, well, we just couldn't kick on because we were heading for, if not quite an insolvency event, we're heading for the knackers yard. You know, we were millions in the red. We just had the most successful season in terms of, you know, attendances, television deals on the run to the Seville Cup final, and we still lost a whack of money. So, you know, the whole business operation had to be turned around, and it was. And not only did Celtic not get into any financial trouble, they've actually overachieved. I mean, they're getting hit over the head for how much money they've got. And the dominance from 2003 to now has been unprecedented, absolutely unprecedented. And I think it would be, my view is that you've got to give Peter Lowell, who was the driving force of that, a lot of them. Surely he's got to get kudos for that.
Yeah, good luck to you on here or any other Celtic fan website. One of the supporters, he's a due season Celtic opinion, said, he gets frustrated about myself and Harry Brady because he said he don't seem to understand why supporters are so angry right now. Now, I do understand, but it doesn't even need to say that. No angry, but they're so kind of exasperated over how Celtic should be so much better in all facets. The stadium shouldn't look as if it's like a crumbling, like within it, like, I mean, the like antiquated facilities. We should obviously have a better, a sharper, more agile recruitment strategy. The governance should be different in terms of, we talked about the communication, all those things. But by the same token, I find it difficult, you know, this will go out on Sunday, but me and my family are only boycotting, and I know that'll cause a lot of grief to some people, but I just don't see that the circumstances are there for what I would think about boycotting in any way, shape or form, whether my entertainment or, you know, what I buy, products I buy. I just don't see that threshold being reached for me. But I know that people get so frustrated at that because you take that attitude. And I know you're probably some the same as me. We're considered, I suppose, too close to the board or whatever you might want to say. You've had that a lot. I know I've had that a lot. Am I fair to say that you've had that a lot?
Yeah, it's funny because anybody that knows the workings of Celtic and know that I wouldn't say it was impossible to get close to the board, but it's not a thing. You know, I've never, You know, they'll say, oh, you're close to the border and all that, but you're not. I mean, people say you're protesting too much. I'm not. I'm just stating that, you know, getting nods and information and any kind of relationship with Celtic is quite difficult, because quite probably they're a PLC and they're not in the business of giving out information. Nearly so fine, but I don't mind accusations and things. I mean, we're living in a world where every avenue of criticism is open and it's public, and you get a lot. But that's fine, you know, because we're in the business of giving out criticism ourselves at times. So it's daft in any way to I mean, I think it's really daft to be influenced or in that, but I let people have their say, and that's fine, you know. But I just think, on the boycott, I'm fine. People got to choose what they want to do. And I get the sense of frustration. You know, people want the club to be much better and believe it should be much better. But I'm not a boycotter. The only thing that I do take issue with some of the language about people that are not going to boycott. They're going along to support their club. They don't deserve to be denigrated. Has been drawn up with, you know, trade unions and disputes. Because the other thing which is talked about, not talked about enough, is, and we all operate in certain little bubbles and channels. But the other thing that is not talked about is there are a lot of people who are not irate. I think most Celtic fans will be frustrated and annoyed, certainly after the transfer window, and there'll be. But there's many people who have no stomach for any kind of protest like boycotting the club and all that. This is something that's in the. This is something they do. This is their club. They go along there every week. Great thing, more than a club. It's part of their lives. It's part of their identity, part of their culture. And their non-voice or almost silence has got to be listened to as well.
Yeah, well, I suppose we'll know by the time this comes out on Sunday morning, but it'll be interesting to see how it goes on Saturday night. It's so fractured. It's splintered. There's so many splinters within the support right now.
Yeah, I see.
Look, I mean, I know, because I do quite a lot of political stuff on here, and I know, like, a lot of people are turned off by it. It's just the way that I kind of delineate my kind of Celtic support, and it's through a political lens or whatever, because that's always been for me. But there's plenty of people have absolutely no truck for it, and then, you know, but the Green Brigade, the political stuff I put out, they would be full square behind me on that. But me and them just go polar opposites when it comes to how you behave yourself at games and how you treat your fellow supporters. So therefore, you can be with one. We've got so many different camps, and there's so... It wasn't just Nancy that did Venn diagrams. You know, there's all these Venn diagrams, isn't there?
Absolutely. And you see it with so many. I mean, to take an example, the Poppy, you're right, which is, there would be very strong Celtic voices that would, you know, have no truck with the Poppy. And we see the Green Brigade and you know, I would lean in many ways towards that. But in other ways, I wouldn't, because in this living room, I've got the medals of my relatives, my grandfather. His only trip outside of Scotland, or his only place ever put his feet in the ground outside of Scotland, apart from Ireland, obviously, was Lisbon in 67. But he fought in the Second World War and underwent some trauma in it as well. As an RAF, as a member of the RAF. And my great-grandfather, who came back from the First World War and suffered the effects of gassing on the front for the rest of his shortened life. My dad always told stories of running up Clarence Street in Postle to get his granddad's messages, which would be whatever, you know, he was getting. And his granddad would be sitting with a his head over a hot basin because he couldn't breathe because of being gassed in the First World War. And there's a lot of Celtic people and a lot of Celtic supporters in Scotland will have lineage to those stories. So even the Poppy debate is not as, you know, as structured as well. I mean, you know, you can, it's, Celtic, of course, had a player who's a VC winner, you know. So even then, it's not simple, right? If you want to call it a Republican socialist left-wing club should have no truck with, say, the Poppy, then you say, yeah, but the supporters who have direct links to it. I mean, there's a great series of books by Ian McCallum about the First World War and yes. Four books and Celtic's links to that is really one of the... We're blessed in the club by our historians, I think. Above any club, probably above any club in Britain. You don't want to go. I know there's clubs abroad that have got, but we are really blessed with our historians, and that is a significant contribution. But the reason I'm going down this digression thing is that things are rarely as
black and white.
The thing that's been lost, I think, a lot of times in this debate is the nuance, you know. There is no, but that's modern life. There is no nuance.
Yeah. As I say, I was reading a thing the other day and it was saying that somebody done a study about how teams are booed earlier than ever now at their own home games. Like, I think Real Madrid are getting booed now within about 17, 18 minutes. The guy's trying to end it saying that this, he was saying it's a post-pandemic thing that people are just, they're just, like, on edge, you know, their cups are just ready to overflow.
It's an interesting phenomenon because we all learn from, I think, who we go to the football with. And I went to with the football with two grandfathers. My dad was uninterested in football. Very strange for a man of his time. But he completely had no interest in it at all. And people used to say to me, oh, your dad hates football. My dad didn't hate football. My dad just wasn't interested. My dad hated football the way I hate crochet. I'm just not interested in it. He had no... It was just another... It was really quite unbelievable for her because his father was really interested in it. His three sons were all interested in him. But anyway, I went with one grandfather who was on the maternal side, who was a Shettleston supporter. So we went up to Greenfield Park and supported the town. Another grandfather was a Celtic supporter. And he only occasionally, because Celtic was he was a hard-working man, and Celtic was his treat. So in these days, he didn't want to be encumbered with... he had so many grandsons, so he didn't want to be encumbered with that. So, but you got as a treat going to Celtic, and I learned lessons from both of them. But the strongest lesson and the joint lesson that I learned is that you never boo your own team. Never. I mean, that was... My grandfather, both grandfathers would never entertain it. They would both say, no, you're here to support, and if you don't fancy what's going on, don't say it. Now, I can hear people now say, oh, but you've got to protest to let people know that. Fair enough. I'm just talking about the way I was taught. The game was you went and supported your team. And one of the great things I learned as well from my grandfather MacDonald, who was as Celtic as you could be, was to actually watch a game and watch the opposition. Because I remember when Baxter came back to Rangers, there was a lot of chat around him one day about how bad Baxter was, and they were jocular about, you know, he'd come back this and that and all that. And I was young, so I never really partook in it. But we walked up the road with my granddad, and he said, never entertain all that. He says, Baxter's a great player. He says, but you decide what kind of player it is. Go and watch him. See if you watch him. Don't listen to other, you know, listen to other people say, but you make your own judgment. Don't run with everybody saying he's not. He says, Baxter's a player, you know. And so there was these really formative lessons, but that it was a very strong one about people laugh at me at football. If I'm going to a Celtic game, my son's pretty similar. It's usually European games we go to. And, you know, I don't say much during the game at all. I never leave before the end. That's kind of like, I don't care what's going on, I don't leave for anything. And they get really, that's the only time I get really animated in the game, where I think they were playing Club Rouge and it was one each, and we'd come into the game. And from being out of it, something with a wee glimmer actually witness, and we got cornered in the last minute of time added on, and suddenly I'm aware of everybody standing up next to me. This guy's going home. And I go, right, there might be a case for going home because your Wayne's at school night. There might be a case for going home to avoid the traffic, right? But it's 1 minute to go in a Champions League game. But anyway, I digress again.
No, you don't. Like, and for you then, do you remember those kind of pre-Steen days then? So if you're 14...
Yeah, just a wee bit. No, just a very, very... I mean, I was 10 when the most important cup was won, the 65 cup. I was 10. I would say that was the most significant cup in that. That was the one that signalled everything is going to change, you know, a bright new morning. A terrible beauty has been born, you know.
Yeah.
So I was only 10, so I didn't get the significance of it at all, you know, because I was just so young.
So I suppose your kind of awakening then is really kind of when Celtic are one of the best teams in Europe, you know, like probably top
best
four
teams
between that.
Well, best one. I mean, really formative time for me, I would say, was the real formative time for me was, I would say, 1969. Because I'll be 14 then, well, I'll be 13 going on 14. And 69 leading into 70 would be hugely formative for me. Like the cup final 69, Celtic winning against Rangers 4-0. That European campaign of 69-70, which the great moment, of course, being the match at Hampden against Leeds United. So that would be, you know, a time where I was getting, you know, I was able to think about football, I was playing it, I was going to these extraordinary matches, you know, and at the time, even being young, knowing that it was extraordinary.
You know? That's a great thing when you know at the time that. Yeah, I'll remember playing in my band and all that, and you think you were known at the time that this is stuff that you really love and you'll remember the rest of your life. It's always great when you get those moments, and football provides.
Oh, many of them. Absolutely. It provides them. I still get them now. I mean, I was at Malaga v Burgos a couple of Fridays. I always reflect on these things, how much football means in my life. You know, you're sitting in Malaga and really enjoyed the whole thing, the difference, the culture, the way the football was played. But Celtic then were, again, it's really hard to talk to people of an era. In those days, Celtic would go into the European Cup the way the team goes into the Scottish Cup now. We'd go in expecting to win it. People would go, oh, no way. And you go, well, yeah. And if you look at the record, I mean, apart from reaching two finals and winning one, you know, beaten by Inter in a penalty shootout in the semi-final, kicked out by Atletico Madrid in a semi-final, beaten by an extraordinary AC Milan in a quarter-final, who after they defeated Celtic, winning 1-0 at Celtic Park, and I think we were the better team over two legs, went on to scoosh European Cup, as it was known then, by beating Ajax 4-1 in the final. So I think it's would be, if we'd have beat and sort of AC and got to the semi, I think we would have been, you know, favourites for the competition. So, I mean, I'm not saying we could have won 5 or 6 European Cups, but there was certainly potential there to pick up at least another couple. Yeah,
Three wouldn't have been a disservice to their talent.
No, and that was the extraordinary level that you were watching every week, and you knew it as well. I mean, it's not like you knew, and the reason that I'm so keen to say you knew it, because when it passed, and it passed quite, I remember going to Hampden, and I think they beat Ajax 1-0 in that game. I watched Ajax that night, and I thought, uh-oh. The baton's for the first time I'd went to a European game and saw us being outplayed, even though I think we won. I think Johnston scored and we won, but I saw a team that, oh my goodness, they're, you know, our team's maybe just going like this a little bit and this team's going like that. And it wasn't just Niskins and Cruyff, it was players like Surby, etc. You know, you looked at them and went, oh, this is a team that's, they're on the up and they're playing with a vibrancy that maybe just about lost, you know?
Yeah, it was to see, like, Celtic were the team that had kind of modernised. Like, when you watch them, they look like the modern team.
Yeah.
You watch 67 against a team that its time is over. And then you could see that. Because Ajax, I think they won it three times
They did. And that analogy is just spot on. Because you could see, and you see now in modern football, the way the energy drifts to another, not so much now because there's not so many. I mean, nowadays so much is based on money. In those days, so much was on evolution. You could see teams growing. No, you could see, like, AC Milan beating Ajax 4-1 in a final, but saying, this is a decent Ajax team. You know, they've beaten a final, they'll grow. And they do grow, but that doesn't happen so much with teams, it doesn't happen at all with teams outside the top five leagues now, because if they have a team that's growing, they get denuded in the summer. We saw it with Monaco a few years ago. They were a very good team, got to the quarterfinals of what I insist in calling the European Cup. That summer, four or five left. We saw it with the Ajax team that got to the semi-finals and lost to Tottenham. They go, because that's just the way it is now. You know, the idea of, always talk about great managers. I'm reading a terrific book at the moment. I think it's going to be published next week on Helenio Herrera. By Richard Fitzpatrick. I'd recommend it unreservedly. It's just terrific. And when they're talking about building teams and building, Herrera was all about that, and building cultures. Nowadays, it just switches so quickly from top five. And he's talking about, I mean, if you look at the teams like, you know, like the Grande Inter, you know, they're now, even a team like Inter, that's astonishing for a man at my age, now in the periphery of the elite.
Was another chairman that was going on about losing players to Crystal Palace or something?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it brings us, you know, to the Engels thing where, you know, guys can, whatever, can bid £20-25 million for Engels, and it's looked as a punt for them. That's not a huge investment. It'd be like Celtic saying, right, well, you know, buy somebody for £2 million, £2.5 million. If it doesn't work out, you know, it's worth a punt. I mean, that's the level it's got to now.
It's scary. It's scary. But you talk about those times, and I know because we talked about this privately or whatever, but I'm probably about as young as you could be and have any kind of sense of interviewing the Lions and all that. And that's one of the great privileges. Like, I don't want to be old, but I'm glad I was this age, like, being on first name terms with five of them. I think I interviewed nine of them. Ronnie Simpson wasn't so quite forthcoming, and same with Bobby Murdoch. They were kind of more private people. But I think I interviewed all nine, and you're the same. You get to know these people and all that. You think, wow, because that link will be lost now. The next generation of journalists or whatever that could come after us or whatever, you know, that the guys aren't there anymore. You know, or they're not on the scene. They were on the scene as well, as much as anything else, weren't they?
It was one of the, you know, it's one of the great things in your life. I mean, like, remember I was walking towards Celtic Park, and Bertie Auld started shouting at me, you know, oh, they're letting anybody come around here today. And I was there with my son, and Bertie stopped to chat, and my son and him had this great talk about Skepovic. That shows you how long ago it was.
Oh, right.
And they were talking about Skepovic and all that. And Bertie was leaning in and making his comments, and Ali was making his comments. And we walked away, and Ali said, God almighty, I've just talked to a Lisbon Lion. And fast forward 6-7 months, we're walking up again for a European team game, and Bertie's walking towards the the reception, and he shouts, "Oh, Bingian, you were right about Skepovic," you know. You can imagine how a young man would feel that a Lisbon Lion shouting across, you know, the expanse of the Celtic Way to him, you know. And that's, excuse me, that's the things about the Lions. I mean, one of the great joys about the Lions was meeting them and discovering what they were like as human beings. My brothers went on in life to be very much more successful than me. I'm the feckless older brother, you know, that didn't do much with his life and things like that. And, but I remember I interviewed Billy McNeil on Billy's 70th birthday, and they both phoned separately to say, "My God, you've interviewed Billy McNeil, you know, and what was he like?" And of course I said to him, "What was he like? He's an absolute, you know." And they went, "Oh, no, don't tell us that." I said, "No, he's the greatest guy in the world." And, you know, I mean, McNeil, interviewing McNeil, I always say that being in Billy's company, you came out and you walked down the road and you thought you were the legend. That's, you thought, because he was always leaning into, "What do you think about this? And what do you do?" And you went,